How did each of you first hear about the shooting of Tony Robinson, Reverend G?
I was in Kansas City, Missouri last week for a conference. I was actually there giving a seminar about race relations, and we were actually talking about Ferguson because we were only about 3 hours away. And I posted something about my activities, and one of my coworkers sent me a text message and said, "You must not know what's happening in Madison." And so before I could write and ask what, I went to Madison.com, took a look at it, and just said, "Oh my gosh, no, not Madison. I can't believe this." And that was about 11 p.m. Friday night, and I couldn't get to sleep until about 2 a.m. I just could not wrap my mind around the fact that Madison was now facing something like this. It was surreal.
Erica, how did you first hear about this?
Well, I kind of live in the Near East Side neighborhood where the shooting took place, and I just happened to be home with some friends, and people were trying to get down Willie Street at about 7 o'clock to come to my house, and they said that there were, you know, many, many police cars in the street had been blocked off, and my gut reaction was something really horrible has happened because, you know, that's pretty significant in the neighborhood. And then began to get messages from friends who had said that there was a shooting of a young African-American man. And so, you know, through text messages and the like, while things were developing, and similarly was shocked and stunned. And, you know, sort of not rationalizing or thinking in the moment, just more shocked by the circumstances that took place, and getting information as people were showing up and being on the ground.
Now, we should point out this is an ongoing investigation. There's only been limited information so far released to the public about the confrontation between Tony Robinson and the police officer who shot him. But what do people around the country need to know about this case at this time?
I think they need to know that people are horrified. People just feel, in the community, are just feeling terrible. Madison's a wonderful community. I've spent the majority of my life here, and this is just something that many of us thought would never and could never happen here.
Right. I mean, this seems like the city that's not like Ferguson, Missouri. I mean, the city with the national reputation. You know, it ends up on all these polls as, a place that you want to live. We can talk about that reputation.
Sure,
but, you know, with this history of social and political progressivism, yeah, we have this happen.
Well, although I found this very difficult to believe, I've had several discussions with community leaders, with the police chief, with other police officers, just quoting some of the facts that's found in the Race to Equity. I'm sure Erica will talk a little bit about this later. And I said, Madison actually is breeding ground for great disparity. And when you have that level of disparity, it only takes a few things to take place. The fear in the heart of someone in leadership or police officer, the cockiness of a young person, and things could just really escalate. So although on one hand, I never thought this could happen in Madison, I just think the situation is ripe because of the blaring disparities that we have.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with Reverend G in that, you know, I have this dual perspective, one that's both this couldn't happen in Madison, but at the same time not being surprised that it did happen in Madison. And that's because I think that the tragedy of Tony Robinson's death is not disconnected from many of the other disparities that we experience in the community and in Madison and Dane County with respect to African Americans and white well-being. And that the issues, I mean, I think I was surprised too, because in light of Ferguson and after Ferguson, I guess I had assumed that our consciousness would be more raised around incidences like this, and that therefore something like this couldn't happen,
right?
Because we are conscious of what happened in Ferguson. But at the same time, because of the great degree of disparities and because of, you know, what we talk about as the racialization of poverty, there's all these associations and unconscious biases that come to the forefront. And I think, you know, the community is mourning. It's in shock. I think there are folks that are angry. And while we don't know the individual facts of the situation, it is a representation of many injustices that the community, particularly the African-American community, feels here, feels in the state, and feels nationally.
Well, Reverend G, your Fountain of Life Church has become a kind of meeting place for mm-hmm. members of the community, especially African-Americans, to talk about problems dealing with a racial divide, including issues like this. And I know there was a gathering at your church right after this happened of, I believe, specifically African-American men and their sons.
Yes, right? Yes. We had a gathering on Saturday. It was a speak out. So it was actually a press conference. And then the broad community gathered on Sunday afternoon. I did make an appeal to African-American men and their sons, their nephews and their grandsons. And it was a beautiful gathering. But what was very interesting is when the men started talking to the young boys, the teens, with a fatherly tone to assure them that, hey, we'll work through this. In the midst of talking to the young men, we realized that we'd been traumatized, that something was triggered in us. And so while we were stating to one of the gentlemen in the group who is a mental health professional, stating that we need to make sure that we take care of our kids, as, you know, we've seen this happen when there have been school shootings, you bring the psychologists out. As we were making that recommendation, a few of the guys just sort of raised their hands and said, you know, I'm not quite feeling like myself. And so I realized that as an adult male, I probably need to talk to someone as well. So one of the things that was really blaring to me is that as we worked to comfort the boys, we had to work through our own pain and our own trauma. And I think that surprised many of us. Of course, we're sad because mm-hmm. it's the death of a young man. But to have that trigger something deep within us was something that I don't think we were aware of. And I'm still feeling the effects of that.
Well, you both talked about how, I mean, even though all that you know about racial inequities in Madison, this, as we've said, this famously progressive town, I mean, you know the problems. You were still surprised that this happened here, right?
Yeah, I think I was surprised by the reality of it, right? Because mm-hmm. from my perspective as the project director of the Race to Equity Report, one of the things that we did is it's a policy and data analysis report, and also has qualitative insights on it, on the lived experience of African Americans here in Dane County. That being said, the deep truth of this event happening and making these disparities and these issues so real, I think, is sort of the tragedy, sort of the trigger in it all, in that we are operating from a policy place, a place of discussion, a place of community conversations about race, conversations about policing and institutional and structural racism. Mm-hmm. And then when in the midst of all of these conversations and a lot of positive progress, we have this event. And I think that is part of the shocking part, too, because the community as a whole over the last 18 months, 2 years, was really building momentum and having open discussions about race.
And this was fairly new, right? I mean, I know, Reverend G, you've been talking about these issues for years, but in terms of bringing these discussions of racial disparities in Madison to a citywide audience, that's really been just going on for a couple of years or so, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in the work that we're doing with Justified Anger, we're finding reports that were written back in the 40s. Right. We found something that the Community Foundation put together in the early 90s. Dr. John Odom wrote something for the school district in the early 70s. So we find these documents. Of course, we didn't have the benefit of social network and social media, but there have been discussions or attempts to have discussions on a broad community level, the tipping point that the Urban League put out a number of years ago. So they've been there, but people, I think, have been able to push them to the side because they've said this is Madison and that data doesn't compute. I think that one of the things that has made this so traumatic for the broader community, not just the African-American community, mm-hmm. but for the broader community, is the combination of two things. On one hand, we felt, many of us felt, this could never happen in Madison, while at the same time, it's our worst fear. And typically, if something's your worst fear, maybe someone will burglarize you, it may never happen in your life. But to have something that you think could never happen and it's your worst fear take place, it's almost as if the inevitable is happening. So to have watched Ferguson and Staten Island and what happened in Cleveland and other places, And then to watch that from afar and to wrestle with it, to take to the streets. My daughter was inconsolable when the Ferguson ruling came down. Then to find out that a young man had been shot in Madison on Willie Street was just, it's crazy. It's like a hurricane coming to Madison. Mm-hmm. That's not supposed to happen inland. And I really think it took people, and is still taking people, some time just to reel from that. So I think it's the combination of something that we think will probably never happen, but it's our worst fear. And when it does happen, it's almost you almost feel badly that you let your guard down to think that that couldn't happen. So you feel the sucker punch of it all as well.
Hmm. So what do we do with the reputation of Madison as being this progressive city? I mean, obviously, it's got all kinds of problems. How do we put these two things together?
Well. I mean, I think that, as Reverend G said, that the race equity report, which was released in October of 2013, was sort of built upon the shoulders of other reports, including the Tipping Point by the Urban League, that highlighted many disparities in well-being between African Americans and whites. And I think what, in many ways, coupled with Reverend G's column and editorial in the Cap Times, Justified Anger, with the race to equity report, that sort of recatalyzed the conversation.
It put some numbers on
the
problem.
And
we should mention some of those numbers. I mean, they're startling. I mean, you found, in your race to equity report, you found, for instance, that unemployment in Dane County was a quarter of the African American community was unemployed, compared to what, the 18% in the national average, and compared to 5% of Caucasians in Dane County. So a quarter of all African Americans in Dane County were unemployed, 5% Caucasians. That's stark.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary, because I think the idea that, when you look at Madison, Dane County, or the state of Wisconsin in the aggregate, we look great. You know, we make the top 10 lists of the best places to live. But when you disaggregate things by race, we recognize that when it came to well-being, like unemployment, as well as education, health, juvenile justice, the adult criminal justice system, African Americans here in Dane County were, on average, doing worse than African Americans anywhere else in the nation. So that's an urban environment, that's a southern environment. And I think that people, because Madison and Dane County has such a good reputation, that many of these issues that people were trying to bring up earlier in the past three decades sort of got brushed under the rug, because it was in many ways easier to rely on the status quo of Madison's reputation than to address these stark disparities. And I think the other challenge here is that white well-being, in terms of education and all these sort of indicators, is better than the national average. And so the notion that a rising tide lifts all boats is not taking place here. And in fact, it's African Americans are doing worse. So what is it that we're missing as a community? What is, you know, part of the solution going forward when we recognize that the rising tide isn't lifting all boats? And I think the first step, which we have begun to take, is that, in fact, we are not necessarily the community that we thought we were. We are not necessarily the community that the rest of the nation thought we were. And it's really important not to continue to ride this sort of self-satisfying reputation going forward, but rather address head-on our issues so we can prevent in the future another Tony Robinson in our community.
And Reverend G, I'm guessing those numbers that the Race to Equity report revealed were not especially surprising to you.
No, because we read some of them in the Tipping Point, but we also know, we recognize it and we talk about it. I think one of the things that was so stark and very important to me when I read the Race to Equity was that someone put new numbers or recent numbers to a growing problem, and the broader community seemed to pick it up and read it. I don't remember that being the case with the Tipping Point or some of the other reports that I referred to. It seemed as if people were talking about it in the mainstream. And many of us in the African-American community sighed with a sigh of relief and said, finally, people are reading the numbers and they're saying, disparities are the worst in the nation. And we've been saying those things. We've been saying the reputation, or talking about the reputation that Madison has with our peers. And so with regards to what do we do with our reputation, I think we take a hard look at ourselves to find out who we are really, because I think trying to protect an ideal or reputation that really wasn't accurate has hindered us from really becoming a very caring and inclusive and progressive community. And I'm willing to work side by side with government, governmental business leaders, leaders from all sectors to help us to become that community. But I have no interest in playing into the facade of pretending that we are some ideal out of the 1960s and watch people in the community die in the process while we laud who we used to be or who we used to think we were. I'm no longer committed to that image.
I'm going to follow up on these numbers that you've been referring to. I mean, mm-hmm. specifically regarding the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. In 2012, black adults in Dane County were 8 times more likely to be arrested than white adults. And that was twice the black-white arrest disparity in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. more than 3 times the disparity around the country. I mean, that is a really sharp division.
Yeah. And I think that division, I mean, lots of people talk about when they talk about issues of disparities and these numbers, is they talk about a sort of school-to-prison pipeline notion that the schools are funneling kids of color into the prison system. And I think that is in some ways the case here, but I think we have to look broader into an economic well-being end of the pipeline, sort of, or funneling of the pipeline. And that is, if you look at high unemployment rates, you look at high poverty rates for African Americans, you look at community structures, you look at the graduation rate, you have a lot of folks who want to participate in the community, want to participate in the economy, and don't have the opportunities to do that. And so one of the consequences of that is they end up being arrested and incarcerated disproportionately. I mean, the state of Wisconsin has the highest African-American incarceration rate in the nation, and Dane County is contributing to that rate and that ratio for the state. And so the criminal justice system is the end of circumstances in many ways.
Right.
It's not the beginning. So we have to think about how do we back up and we prevent these high disparity rates in arrests and in incarceration for African-Americans and African-American males in particular within this community.
I know there's been a lot of talk about these issues of racial disparities over the decades, but it seems like there's been a much more concerted effort just in the last few years in Madison to talk about this as a citywide community. What's changed?
Well, I think it was sort of this culmination of the release of the Race to Equity Report, which was quantitative accounts of the well-being of African-Americans versus whites in our county. And it was very much policy, had some ideas about drivers and of these disparities. And then what was so complimentary was that we released this report. There was a lot of conversation about it because of the numbers, because of the starkness of it. And then Reverend G's article said, these aren't just numbers. This is really lived experience of African-Americans in the community. And so people couldn't just push us to the side and say, oh, these are just numbers. This is them just talking. But actually, you know, having Reverend G's article.
Okay,
saying,
for people who haven't read the article, can you talk about it a little bit, Reverend G?
Sure. It was an article I wrote for December 18th. Cap Times 2013, and I just talked about my experience being pulled over by the police in my church parking lot and just being questioned as to why I was there. And I start off the article by saying I talked about mass incarceration at downtown Rotary, and someone congratulated me afterwards for not being an angry black man. And I said, well, I am. And they continued to insist that I wasn't. And I left that meeting pondering, why was it so important for her to feel that I wasn't angry? I just talked about Wisconsin leading the nation in the incarceration of black men. And then I just started talking about experiences with my daughter, things that have happened in the community, things that men have said to me, and just started talking about that and talking about the fact that many African Americans are not at the decision tables. And when there are discussions about diversity, we're nowhere around, and just really gave my perspective on it. And I think if I were to explain the tone of it succinctly, I would say I came out of hiding a bit because I felt that no one wanted to hear a middle class black male bemoan public life in Madison. But I realized that if I didn't share my story, many men who are not as fortunate, who have been telling me their stories, would not feel justified and would not feel that their voices and experiences were real. So I really wrote that for solidarity, having no idea how it would really complement the work of the Race to Equity team. But I think Erica's right. I think it was that perfect storm. And it wasn't very far off the heels of the Madison Prep discussion. So I think over the past several years, we've been talking about this more as the demographics change in Madison. So we have social media, we have numbers, we have stories, we have articles, but then our kids are going to school with diverse populations. And so I just think it was tangible, and I think it was easy to believe it, and I think people wanted reasons for some of the actions, the failure that they saw, opportunity gaps that they saw for young children of color. And I think the Race to Equity helped to explain some of what people were asking themselves.
Well, it strikes me that maybe part of the problem is the language that we use. I mean, you know, the word racism gets thrown around loosely, and, you know, it's hard to pin down, frankly. And it seems like what your report has done, Erica, is, I mean, you've attached quantifiable numbers to a lot of these very specific issues, unemployment, incarceration rates. Do we need a new way of talking about these problems?
Or a new way of looking at existing problems? And I know that the word racism is daunting, but, I mean, you can give cancer a nice name. You can call it butterflies, and it's still... you know, it's still a death sentence. And so I'm not sure if it's semantics or jargon as much as it is. We just have to look at these issues and realize this is what's happening. I grew up in this community. I can remember being in high school in the late 70s, 80s, starting college here in the early 80s, and there being rhetoric about outsiders, people from Milwaukee and Chicago and from the South, not understanding the ways of Madison, not getting our strong school systems and school programs, and they weren't academically astute enough to really succeed here. But I can name you 8-10 African Americans who were born in Madison General Hospital, and I'm purposely using the old hospital names, Methodist Hospital, St. Mary's Hospital. They were born here. Their parents were raised here, and they were not succeeding in middle school and high school. So to pin the failure of our kids on outsiders is to shift blame and responsibility and not look at the core issues of what's happening, what are the root causes, so that we can begin to rectify these issues. And so I just feel that we spend more time skirting the issues and denying them than really looking at them and dealing with them. I still believe that we are a smart community, a compassionate community, and if we didn't spend as much time hiding from reality and spent more time dealing with it, we could change the issues and not just the terminology. We could change the issues, but we're not even willing to have the talk because it's too painful and we don't want to be that. And in avoiding talking about that, we've become that.
What do we need to talk about?
We need to talk about the systemic issues, how we got here, why we don't see more diversity among teachers. If you look at the at systems or structures in our community that have tried to keep up with the changing demographics, the medical professions have not done that. Professors haven't done it. Media hasn't done it. Police have. And I'm not trying to tie anything negative into that, but that's one department, one workforce that you can look at and say it's really tried to keep up with the changing demographics. Judges haven't. Social workers haven't. So we have to look at what's happening here. Why aren't we attracting people? Why aren't we keeping people? What's really happening in the trenches? We often talk about children who are failing. We talk about that a bit in Eric and her team talk about that in the Race to Equity report. But we rarely talk about the academically astute African-American children and children of color who are in advanced placement classes. But they're having to defend their right to be there. My daughter's a freshman at UW-Madison, and it's having discussions that my mom had 50 years ago when she was a freshman here, my daughter is taking someone's spot at the university, some well-deserving white person, as if when you're born in Wisconsin and you're white, you're given a card that entitles you to come to Wisconsin. So the assumption is my daughter's either an athlete or she's here on some type of special admit program, and she's on an academic scholarship. So not only are our children who are wrestling academically, I'm having to face that. The children who are not wrestling academically are wrestling socially because they are constantly justifying their presence in a school and a system where they have earned their spot. Yet we don't talk about that. We don't talk about the lack of teachers and professors and administrators. And we have to ask why that is. And what we typically say, and I'm a former University of Wisconsin employee and a graduate of UW-Madison. I love it. But we would often say, well, we'd like to get more faculty, but if we hire them, Michigan would just come and steal them. If they'd come here, they could work at Michigan. And we would say those kinds of things. We would say, well, if we'd attract someone here, they'd want to live in Milwaukee or Chicago. The climate is similar. It's pretty close. So why would anyone want to come here? And we almost throw our hands up.
So, I guess it does raise the question, why don't we attract a more diverse workforce in all these different professions you've just named?
I think it's because we don't wrestle with environmental issues here, and I mean cultural environmental issues. We often talk about diversity. We don't want diversity in Madison. We want a Jackie Robinson, and that's not diversity. That's having the wherewithal to hit the ball out the park, but the stamina to deal with the name calling and to take your wife on the road with you to grow and to experience all of that. So it's one thing to be a good ball player in the major leagues. It's another thing to handle all of the other emotional turmoil that comes with that. For a person to come to Madison, it's not just moving geographically. It's breaking the color barrier. You're the only one in your class, in your department, in your office, in your division, and you're the spokesperson. And they want to know why and how. And what they really want to know is, how did you get here and who did you know and what's your background and can I touch your hair?
What were your connections that allowed you to get here?
Connections. They're testing you to make sure that it wasn't some giveaway. And you have to deal with all of that and be able to handle it if you really want to be here. Whereas in other settings, you don't have to deal with all of that. Why do you dress that way? Why do you put this on? You know, just there's so many things that aren't cruel. It's not cross burning on your lawn. But those, just speaking personally, those kinds of offhand comments often said to me, we really see you as different. Because I didn't get up every day as a kid and attend school thinking I'm different. I just didn't think that. But when I was asked, can I touch your hair, or why is your skin dark, or these different questions, that reminded me that people didn't see me as an insider. And that told me that people saw me as other. And then eventually I started feeling like other. So then when I saw others, I gravitated towards them because I didn't have to explain or justify. But then that made the broader community nervous because they wanted to know, well, why are all the black kids sitting together? Why are all the black kids talking together? Why do they sit on the buses together? And so just some of those things, we have so much more work to do. We have so much work to do. And those are small things. I don't talk to African-Americans who say that people are burning crosses on their lawns. I can count on one hand how many times I've been called the N-word here in Madison, but it's more the insensitive things towards culture that have just made it uncomfortable at times.
And I don't know if it's not intentionally insensitive. I think it's an unknowing. It's a lack of experience.
Agree.
I mean, I think what Madison and Dane County lack is a thriving, diverse, inclusive place. And that's why people don't come, one, because it's not Atlanta, and they're not going to stay because the things that Reverend G talk about are more stressful in your day-to-day life. And if you can find opportunities elsewhere, regardless of how beautiful Madison is and its lakes, it is easier to go somewhere else. And
let me just add, I'm just sort of curious, following up on this at
sure.
a personal level. So Reverend G, you've lived in Madison for years. Mm-hmm. Ever thought about moving away?
All the time.
So why do you stay?
Because I understand the territory, I understand the environment, and I want to be a role model to children and to families who are trying to acclimate themselves to Madison. Madison's given a lot to me. And so I try to be balanced. Just because I have issues with something or a place doesn't mean that I negate everything that's good about it. My mom was in an abusive marriage. Madison was a new start for her. She got to come to college. She got a new gleam in her eye. She got her undergrad and graduate degree here. She became a new woman. I appreciate Madison for that. And because of that, I'm doing what I'm doing. I am who I am. My sister's doing what she's doing. I appreciate Madison for how it allowed my mom to blossom. That was in her, but Madison gave her room and space. So when I see Madison being a little stingy with those same resources and not as welcoming and not as warm in its heart to new people who are arriving, it angers me because 50 years ago, we were those West Chicago people migrating to Madison for a better life or more benefits or to double dip in welfare, whatever the thought is. But I just think I've been able to contribute to this community because I've always felt like I was a part of it. When people don't feel that they're a part of it, you lose future Alex G's. To the extent that I offer something to this community, I'm not unique. I'm not special. I was given an opportunity. I was trained to take advantage of it, and I did it. But there are children sharper, more articulate, clear, focused, strong. But many times their spirit is just zapped. Yeah. Because people aren't relating to them. And that breaks my heart because we have the kinds of people who can make Madison more inclusive. But if their spirits are drained or depleted, they never really grow. And that's what's heavy to me. So when I think of leaving, I realize anyone can just move and just say, you know, this is awful. This isn't working. But it takes some resolve to make it better for the next family or for the next generation. And people stuck it out so that my mom could come. And I want to stick it out so that others can come.
And I think, you know, to sort of build on what Reverend Gia said, it's not cut and dry. It's actually kind of complicated because Madison provides a myriad of opportunities and that's why people come. That's why people, white, black, Latino, you know, all races and ethnicities, and come to Madison because of the quality of life. The question becomes for us now is, regardless of who you are, do you have equity of opportunity when you in fact arrive? Because one of the things is, I think that people come with this sense of hopefulness and this possibility. And then when they actually arrive and get settled, they say, oh, this is really complicated. For some reason, I can't find a job. I can't find affordable housing. I can't find, or my child, I came for the top 10 public education systems in the country. And it turns out that only applies to a particular group. That doesn't apply to my children.
Well, and let me ask for you, I mean, just very personally, Erica, yeah. I know you lived in Madison before, then you moved away to New York. You've come back.
I know. I keep
you
on
have
coming back.
a couple of young mixed race children, right?
Yes, I do. And I think that is complicated. I mean, we came back for the opportunities of the public education system, and we were not aware of the disparities in education before we arrived. And when we came from Brooklyn, New York, back to Madison, we knew it wouldn't be Brooklyn, New York. We knew that it wouldn't be that sort of thriving, intense diversity. But what we didn't expect was sort of this really striking feeling in the differences in the community and the overall sense of hopefulness or well-being. And my children are doing great, but that's also because I'm pretty intense about it and I'm pretty aware of what's going on, and because I'm highly networked and have the resources to advocate on behalf of my children. I have that privilege. And so they're going to ultimately be fine. The question becomes, are my daughter's peers, the African-American boys and the African-American girls that she is friends with, going to do as well? Because they deserve to do as well as she does and to have the social capital to make that happen so that they can graduate high school, can go on to college. That, you know, from a personal perspective, it's complicated because I love it here and I have family here and I was born in Wisconsin. And I left and I came back and I left and I came back again. So there is something really wonderful. And I think that the community has the power and the capacity to make change and to make significant social change.
How much do you think this story that we've been talking about Madison, I mean, the racial inequities here, how much of this is a story about America?
Well, from my perspective, I think that we are in some ways an exaggerated story of what's taking place in terms of the distance between well-being of whites and African-Americans. But in other ways, we are a reflection of a larger national story. You know, the disparities and the distance in well-being is very much grounded in our history, in the history of African-Americans in this country that has been disadvantaging blacks for hundreds of years and privileging whites. And Much of our structures, policies, practices are built upon this dynamic. And so now it becomes unpacking that dynamic. And while people are unpacking it across the country, our challenge becomes, can we be a model for beginning to address these institutional and structural practices and policies that disadvantage African Americans and privileged whites? Can we do that? And I actually believe that we can when we look at the issue, not in isolation just in terms of adult incarceration or in terms of third grade reading proficiency, but when we look at it comprehensively, when we look at, you know, you're only going to succeed if you can read, right? So, and if you're getting disproportionately suspended because you're African American, then your likelihood of ending up in the juvenile justice system is going to increase. And then your likelihood of ending up in the adult criminal justice system is increased. We have to approach this and look at this and address this in a very comprehensive way that focuses not just on our children, but also on the parents of those children. Who are the family, the support, the ones that are caring for these youth and children, and they need to be stable. They need to be part of the community and have opportunities themselves so that it becomes sort of this two-generation strategy or approach that means that we can make progress sooner than waiting for the 10-year-olds to become 20-year-olds. You know, we can make progress now on this, I think.
Reverend Dree, how do you see this question of whether Madison is a microcosm of racial problems around the United States?
I'd have to agree with what Erica shared. I think I'd say in many growing cities or urban areas, I think the delineation between races and where they live is fairly clear. You cross this street, you cross these tracks, you cross this highway, and you know how the communities are broken up. Things are pretty mixed together here in Madison. That's one of the things I noticed when I moved here as a kid. And people say, notice when they come, there's not like a set street or block that's for black businesses or black shops. But I think that gives us a false sense of inclusion because we attend the same schools, we live in the same neighborhoods. It doesn't mean that we have meals together. It doesn't mean that we have play dates with our kids. And so I think it is a microcosm, but it's not as obvious because we don't have those dividing lines and those dividing streets. I think the division happens on other levels. But I think it's a microcosm. I think because of our size, we're probably a bit more aware of it. But I also think that we are at times like deer in the headlights, that we see that it's coming at us. And we're not really sure what to do or what steps to take. And I think the community is really taken aback by a growing minority community that's saying, this is not utopia. This is not ideal. When they hear someone like myself say, you know, I live in Fitchburg, I'm middle class. I have an advanced degree. My wife has a college degree. And I talk about inequities. Sometimes my friends have looked at me in disbelief because they're saying, "Okay, you're the Huxtables. You're the family on Blackish. Come on, you don't understand disparity." But I see what's happening to people around me. I see people who are sharp and smart who are struggling. But I think they'd be shocked to know that if my 18-year-old daughter were a son, I probably would have taken other job offers in Madison because I felt we could navigate because the statistics aren't the same. Not that they're much better, but they're not quite the same.
Being a young black man is really difficult.
And I don't know any African-American moms who aren't afraid for their sons. And not that their sons are going to go to the corner and buy a gun. They're afraid that they're going to be cut from a sports team so that they'll become a part of the subculture of the school. And won't worry about eligibility and will start hanging out in front of the schools. And then they won't be given the same shots or the same chance or the same opportunities. I don't know a single mom. And that doesn't stop when it's two family, a household that's head of a two family. That fear doesn't change. And so I know families with young men, both parents are professionals, and they're just as afraid as a single mom about the safety of their child. And that's frightening because in other cultures, the more stabilized kid could balance the kid that was edgier. They're both just as edgy and both just as at risk because with the unconscious biases, you see the kid, their skin color, their hair texture, and we automatically make some assumptions.
And I think just to sort of follow up on that and build upon your question, in some ways, structurally, Madison and Dane County are a reflection of our national circumstances and our history. But also, on the other hand, I think we have some unique circumstances here where the notion that you, because the disparities in poverty, in child poverty, in unemployment, and the like are so stark, we have this sort of racialization of poverty circumstance where you can't, here I personally don't believe that you can say, oh, this is just about class. This is not about race. I believe that they're inextricably linked, and therefore, because race and poverty or your level of education are so closely correlated in this community, because the disparities are so stark and because the African American community is relatively small, you end up having circumstances where there are lower expectations based upon your skin color. So the middle class family that has that's African American, that has professors at the university, that same student for some reason will be sort of lumped into this sense of expectations that they won't excel. Or the phenomenon, which is more qualitative than quantitatively based, and that is that African American families and parents will send their kids to public school systems outside of the Madison Metropolitan School District where there are fewer black kids, so that their children can be an exception to what seems to be a rule.
I want to come back to the question of policing. Reverend G, you said earlier that the Madison Police Force is one case where there really has been diversity in the hiring. There are a lot of black police officers, and yet we've just had this this tragedy of the white police officer shooting and killing a young man of mixed race. I mean, we don't know the circumstances yet. We'll still find out about that. And we've also heard that the police force here has taken steps to have racial sensitivity training. I mean, it would seem like this is a police force that has done things right.
I personally think that, that racial sensitivity needs to go a step further. I just know human nature. I'm a diversity consultant. People are forced to take those things. It's when you hear that it's diversity day, or we're going to have the training, the eyes roll because people feel that they're going to be called racist and they're going to be given information that they don't need. And many people are just thinking if you don't get in trouble, you don't have to worry about your race. And so the training is offered. But I'd want to ask, how do you measure its efficacy? How do you know that it's taking root? And isn't this evidence that perhaps some of the training that they're taking does not help with the unconscious biases as much as it really should? I mean, if you don't have regular interaction and you're threatened by the image of someone, how does that not play into your interaction? And that's the part that I really think about. And Erica said this earlier, when you have great disparities, expectations are lower. And because of the sheer numbers, by the luck of the draw, if you meet someone tall, African-American, mixed race, the unconscious biases just begin to unravel in your head. So you begin to think, okay, who's this person? You know, what are they likely to do? And we have to be able to get at that. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know exactly how you get at it. But I know that what we're doing is not quite enough. We can't just have sensitivity training that we just check off. But I hear of the comments. I talk with police officers. My brother's a police officer in Chicago. So I understand, love, respect, appreciate law enforcement. But I also know human nature. I mean, I know human nature. And so I think we can't say that everyone who's in law enforcement is bad, but we can't say that they all walk on water. And I think this is where African American people really get frustrated. We rarely hear, except in cases when you hear Erica and her team talk, you don't hear a lot of people saying, this is a racist system. That was a racist act. It's always an extreme. No, he wasn't a racist. He was deranged. He was bullied. He was whatever. But you rarely see someone saying, okay, you know what? We have some training, but that was a racist act. Or that might have been racially motivated. And so I think in the minds of many Madisonians, that's a phenomenon that we sort of talk about, but it's sort of like the Northern Lights. We know it exists, but very few people can really say that's it right there. And I think that that's what makes this so difficult because, you know, when there's a shooting, we talk about the accolades of an officer and then the arrest record of a young dead mm-hmm. victim. What's that about? That's painful for me mm-hmm. because there are two sides to every story. So if we're going to say something negative about a young man, let's also talk about his positive accolades and let's do that in the same medium. But when and I noticed this with Ferguson, that when Michael Brown was shot, the chief came out and started talking about the accolades of the officer. And you do not do that. I'm a pastor. I have staff that I love. But if there's an accusation that someone did something to hurt a child, the first words out of my mouth was not going to be, this is an Eagle Scout. I trust him with my kids. I'm going to work to be neutral and to try to really be a public servant and try to serve both sides of it. I just think nationally, this is just handled poorly. And every time it is, it opens old sores and old wounds. And so people want to say, well, aren't the police showing transparency? Aren't they being very open? But let's look at the other cases. No one, the police chief didn't get up and say, no, we're going to be obscure. We're going to be very convoluted. We're going to be very, secretive. Everyone said, we're going to be fair. We're going to do it by the books. We want you to rest assured this is going to be a just process. And so I just think when you have the kind of history that we have in this country, it's so hard to believe that things are going to get better. And the community is just reeling because the weightiness of this, it continues to aggregate and it's reliving old pains.
Hey, Erica, I know that you and your team have developed a toolkit to deal with some of these issues and that I'm guessing could be taken elsewhere as well. Anything specifically about some of these criminal justice systems?
Well, I think
problems
that
we've been talking about.
The Race Equity Toolkit was sort of done in partnership with the YWCA of Madison to allow folks to sort of have deeper, more involved discussions about what surrounded the Race to Equity report. You know, have conversations about what structural and institutional racism is and unconscious bias, right? So there's these these processes that you can go through in the Race Equity Toolkit to have discussions with your community members or your family or whomever you want. And the Race Equity Report was a jumping off point for that. I think that conversations, communication, talking about it forthright is really absolutely important. I think inclusivity and diversity training is important. I think reviewing police practices in terms of force is important. All these things are very important and they all need to happen. I think it's also really important to recognize, too, that whether we have a diverse police force or they're well-trained or they're participating in diversity, inclusivity, cultural competency training, it is apparent to me that we will not have resolution or a solved answer to many of these circumstances overnight. That this is something that you repeat and you do over and over and over again, and you chip away at it for the next 20 years, not the next 20 months. And it is a decades-long, generational circumstance, whether it's policing, whether it's the education system, that we have to sort of begin to unpack, and it certainly isn't going to happen overnight. God forbid, I would not want another shooting. But it's possible, right? And not here, it's possible somewhere else in the nation. And because we cannot undo so much of what's there, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to take us a long time. And I think doing these things is, all these things are extraordinarily productive and positive. But it's really important to recognize that it'll take us generations to make long-lasting, across-the-board improvements and to sort of chip away at our own unconscious bias.
Let me end with maybe practical solutions. I mean, you've just said we need to take this long-range view. But if there's one thing in particular that we should do right now as a community, given what has just happened, we've just had this shooting in Madison. You've talked about all of the racial inequities that we have here. What's like the one thing that you'd want our community to focus on right now, if there is one thing?
We'd have to focus on still having unity as a goal, to not let this become a huge setback. And that means even though we're having pain and we're experiencing turmoil, we can't lose all trust in humanity and each other. We can't revert back to 40 or 50 years ago and draw a strong dividing line and just say we can't trust anyone who's white, anyone who wears a badge, anyone who's a kid or wearing a hoodie and is black or of mixed race. I think we have to remind ourselves that this is one officer, and this is not all police, and this is not all Madisonians, and this isn't just this is one kid. This is not all kids. So I think we have to make sure that we don't lose sight that we have to live and live together beyond this, and we need to find ways to put ourselves in situations where we have to talk, grieve, and communicate. So putting a strong emphasis in continuing to talk together and live together, and not become separated.
Erica, what's the one thing you'd want to focus on right now?
I think Reverend G said, you know, community continuing to have, you know, solidarity and unity across all races and ages. But I think, you know, coming out of this and coming out of the morning, that as a community, the private sector, the public sector, everyone and anyone who has any influence redoubles their efforts to address inequities and lack of opportunities
yes.
for children and families and youth of color. Like, that is the charge that we have reemphasized to us on this Tuesday afternoon.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.